everybody. Welcome to episode number 405 of Film Wax Radio. Well, we are now steeped in the Tribeca Film Festival. And, you know, without even really trying, I've seen like 10 movies. Now, this is not necessarily that impressive compared to a lot of people that are at the festival, mind you. But, well, it's only a few days into the festival. But I it's funny because I just figured, you know, I'm going to go to the Sarasota Film Festival, which I didn't end up going to. And I'm going to go to the Montclair Film Festival, which is nearby. And then I'm going to go to the Maryland Film Festival this year for the first time. And then, you know, we have rooftop films. And we have so much stuff going on. I figured I really don't need to go to Tribeca. And though, as I went through the roster this year, there were easily a dozen different filmmakers that I considered friends or who had been on this podcast before or who I've screened their films in my series or something. I had a relationship. And so I really decided I better get the badge because I need to see some of these films. So, and I have been just in the last few days alone. I'll just brief you on a few. Today, in fact, I might as well start here. I actually saw the documentary Gilbert about Gilbert Gottfried, which I'd really been wanting to see for some time because I feel like, you know, first of all, he's got a podcast and, you know, I sort of look at him as a colleague in that regard. And his co-host on his podcast, you know, Gilbert Gottfried's amazing, colossal podcast, is co-hosted by Frank Santopadre, and through social media, Frank and I have kind of become a little bit friendly. I don't want to exaggerate it, but we sort of, you know, text back and forth, and I'm a big fan of that podcast. So I had been wanting to see Gilbert for a while, I think even last year, even though he was in that other documentary about the young boy with autism, Life Animated, directed by my former guest Roger Ross Williams. I thought that there was something else, like maybe there was some work in progress. I don't know if that's possible, but anyway, here it is a year later, and the documentary filmmaker Neil Berkeley has this documentary about Gilbert Gottfried. So I do recommend it if you can. Neil had a documentary out a couple of years ago called Harmontown, about Dan Harmon, a Lion producer. Anyway, this Gilbert's very good, as I mentioned. So I'm recommending that. I also saw Intent to Destroy, which is Joe Berlinger's new documentary about, well, this is really simplifying it, but it's about the Armenian genocide back in, I think it was 1915. And I'm going to be meeting with Joe as I record this tomorrow to record a segment for the, you know, a future podcast. In fact, Joe has been on before, so this will be his second appearance. And I think we're going to try to do a third one when the new documentary, which is called Intent to Destroy, has its theatrical, which will probably be a few months away. And then I saw a terrific documentary about Hedy Lamarr called Bombshell, The Hedy Lamarr Story, directed by a filmmaker named Alexandra Dean. And I also saw former Film Wax Radio guest Josephine Decker, her new film called Flames, which she co-directed with her ex-boyfriend, Zephyr Throwell. I'm not positive how you pronounce that. Also, Oren Moverman and The Dinner, starring Richard Gere and Laura Linney and Rebecca Hall and Steve Coogan. This is a great little film, and we just did this yesterday. We met, and it's also Oren's second time on the show, and I got to tell you, this is a great conversation. I've really come to like Oren Moverman quite a bit, and so it was a pleasure to have him on again, and hopefully it's the second of many appearances. Also, a terrific documentary called No Man's Land, directed by David Byers and executive produced by Morgan Spurlock. And finally, Sierra Pettengill, who was on this podcast also in the past, has co-directed, along with Pacho Velez, a archival documentary called The Reagan Show. So that's just a handful of the films, and I'm supposed to, and I didn't mention a number of others that I've seen, but I'm going to be seeing some more I think even tomorrow. So that's all coming up at the Tribeca Film Festival. Even a festival I don't intend to see a lot, I end up seeing a lot. But I do have a bunch at Montclair and in Maryland especially that I really want to catch up with. So that's the festival plan for the moment. This is episode number, as I mentioned, 405. And my first guest up here is Ben Wheatley, who is one of my favorite current British directors, or I could just say directors. He hails from the UK. I first became aware of Ben with his first feature. I believe it was his first feature. In fact, I'm pretty certain it was, called Down Terrace. And there's been a bunch since, including A Field in England and Sightseers. And a couple of years ago, he had High Rise. And now he has a new film called Free Fire. And it is currently in theaters, so you'll want to see it. And it's co-stars of Charlton Copley, Brie Larson, Armie Hammer, and Cillian Murphy, and a bunch of other very talented people. And I believe right now, if you're living in New York, it's playing at the Alamo Drafthouse in Brooklyn, as well as the Nighthawk, and where I saw it, as well as at the UA Court Street Stadium Theater. And all around this country of ours. So go see Free Fire for a rollicking good time. And I use those words very, very pointedly, very specifically. And again, Ben Wheatley coming right up in the first segment. After that, we'll be back with two gentlemen who co-directed a documentary called Bang, the Burt Burns story. Burt Burns was a songwriter and music producer whose history and legacy was all but erased by the powers that be at the time. And by the powers, I mean those powerful music industry executives that found him to be a jagged pill, Burt Burns. But he wrote some of the most incredible songs, including his songwriting credit on Twist and Shout, for Pete's sake. Anyway, we will be interviewing Burt's son, Brett Burns, in this second segment, as well as his co-director, Bob Sarles. And I had some technical problems kind of getting it going. So if you hear references, most of it's quite audibly strong. It's done through Skype and phone, but it sounds great. Yeah, but if you hear me talking about technical problems, it's all been edited out of the show, as I try to do to save you from any annoyance. But that's what that is about. Anyway, they are both delightful. The film is wonderful. If you're a fan of music documentaries, you got to see Bang, the Burt Burns story. The documentary is coming out on Friday, April the 28th. So let's not delay any further. Let's get right now into my conversation with the incredibly talented director, Ben Wheatley, regarding his new film, Free Fire. So I basically adopted these mics.
Oh, right, okay.
So, yeah, they were probably used quite a bit in that regard. You're just making me feel like I really need to upgrade my equipment.
No,
so
I think they...
I know. Yeah, they've got some history.
History kind of things that have been,
yeah,
you know, damaged on purpose, like jeans.
Oh, yeah, and distressed.
Yeah, distressed
mics, right, yeah. That's right, yeah. That's
could
right.
Be new, could well, be a new thing.
Well, I can tell you I'm distressed. Go ahead. Enjoy your hot beverage.
Holy fuck, that is hot.
Okay, yeah.
It's hot. Is it strong for you? Is it
That's
strong?
Good, yeah.
You like it strong? Ben Wheatley, wow. This all came together kind of quickly in the last few days. It was thrilling. And I ran over to the Nighthawk.
Ah.
And saw you there. Mm. In front of a really enthusiastic crowd of big fans. So that must have been nice, right?
Yeah. And it's like, I think a third time I've been there as well. It's a great cinema, yeah.
Oh, you've been there before, too?
Yeah, yeah,
They're building another Nighthawk in Park Slope. It's like Brooklyn's version of Soho or something.
Oh, right, okay, cool.
I mean, that's a stretch, but I mean, to give you some shorthand. And now we also have Alamo Draft Houses. So people can drink and eat during a lot of Ben Wheatley films.
It's good, but they can't talk, otherwise they'll be thrown out.
They'll be thrown right, chucked right out, as well as, if they pull out their phone, forget it. You'll be hogtied and dragged by horses, which, may make you feel in a way like you might be in a Ben Wheatley film. So it's a good thing. I just had Walter Hill on, and I was actually the great director, and another great director, I should say. And I was telling him how when I saw 48 Hours originally as a kid, because I'm that old, it was in Times Square back when Square was not as
psychedelic as it is now.
It is a bit psychedelic.
I went there the other day. I thought I was having a flashback to the 90s. It was shocking.
Yeah. What, do you guys have a Times Square, like Leicester Square, I guess? Is that your...
No, it's, in terms nothing, of like it's just, nothing like that with those massive screens, Right. That's crazy.
Oh, yeah. You mean outside and all that. Yeah, it's like Vegas or something. Yeah.
Oh, you mean it's like old school cinema street kind of thing. Well, it's a real shame. Yeah, the Leicester Square's like lost one of its main cinemas, and then they've split one of the big screens in half. So it's kind of, it feels like the end days for those 1,200 seater cinemas, which is a real shame.
It is. Anyway, so Walter Hill. So I just said how when I stepped out of 48 Hours, though, there was literally a cop chase going on with guns drawn, going through Times Square as me and my friend.
Oh wow!
Came out of the theater. So it was like that's when you could really experience life and art merging together.
Imagine what like walking out of Taxi Driver in New York would have been kind of a similar experience. Exactly. Where you just go, oh, I can't stand that documentary I've just watched,
That's right. Exactly. Those early Scorsese films were like documentaries. New York was really that dingy and relatively wife dangerous. Walking up Bowery.
Yeah. Okay. Well, my wife and her mum used to come to New York a lot, and they came in, I would have been mid-80s or something. They said they got off at JFK, and they got on the subway, and then cops got on the subway with them and locked the doors of the subway.
Oh, really?
And then they wouldn't let anyone on until they got into the middle of New York, and then they unlocked the doors, and then they let them out. And they said, welcome to New York.
Yeah, we definitely I don't know if London has been cleaned up like New York has to a great extent, but I mean, I was just walking up two blocks up the Bowery here, and I just can always remember from my childhood to see a sign out of a window saying Bowery Yoga is kind of funny to me because, you expect there are other areas where that's wouldn't, make me think about it. But so you grew up in what part of England?
Initially, until I was 10, I grew up in Essex, which is a county above London.
And I guess to the east? I don't know.
It is the north of London. Okay. Well, kind of northeast, yeah. Right. So it's like kind of...
Understood.
This isn't going to work on a podcast. There. It's here, but then it's over there.
Right. Yeah. It's just... Right, exactly. It's one of a series of hand gestures by the end of the show that Ben gave me. I've been there. I've been there. It was really a beautiful... I have memories of Essex.
Well, it is beautiful, some of it, and some of it's not so beautiful. So it's an industrial... kind of landscape, some of it and some not. So, but I lived in the wood, out in the in a village, and there was a fields and kind of woods near me and stuff. So yeah, I had that childhood, and then moved to central London, and then had the urban
version,
the shocking urban chapter. Version of it. Yeah.
So, when was that roughly?
When I was 10, so 82.
Oh, so your formative years really were in London then?
Yeah. So okay, 82 so to. Yeah, and then I left in, 90 to go to Brighton. And then
Brighton. Yeah. Well, not too far, right? Just a little south of London.
Yeah, I'm not far by your American standards, but like quite a journey by our terrible public transport standards.
Also, I thought you were going to say, even though it may not be so far in distance, it really feels like a really different part of the country because that's what happens. In England, it's like you don't have to go very far, but it's such a different dialect and such a different culture.
Yeah.
So I know Brighton has a really different culture from.
Yeah, well, Brighton's like a hippie town, or it was when I turned up. But it's had the same fate that New York has had. It's like just a load of money poured into the middle of it, and lots of coffee shops turn up, and
there were arts. There was arts.
Yeah.
Is this what got you to like? I guess between growing up in London and then living in Brighton, it's not so surprising you were exposed to probably a lot of. Film, I'm guessing. And
yeah, I mean, Brighton had
John Frankenheimer films or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just thinking of who you were.
Seconds.
Exactly.
I did see Seconds when I was there. I just did the Criterion, robbing the Criterion cupboard video.
Oh, yeah. Thing. Tell me about that.
And I was like, oh, Seconds. I'll have a bit of that. I haven't seen that since I was a kid. Brilliant.
Yeah. Did you ask them, at Criterion, what's my cap? because you don't want to be piggish about it, you know.
Well, it's not so much that. It's a self-regulating thing because you are being filmed. So if you do, you could go crazy, but you would look like an idiot. So
that's right.
And I found it quite hard because I was like, basically, the only films I can talk about are the ones I've already bought, so it's pointless. I'm going to pull this and go, oh, I have not seen this,
well,
but
like,
I want it.
You know? I actually did it too, but because I'm not a filmmaker, they didn't film me. They did take some pictures, but they didn't film me. So I, on the other hand, I said, like, how many? And they said, I don't know, take 10 or so. So some box sets slipped in there.
Yeah.
I really went crazy, but I'm not apologizing
for it. The one to go for is the 20-year anniversary box set, which has got 350 films in it. And I must say, I did have a go at that. And they, have you got that? And no. I was like, where's Criterion 1? No, we don't have that.
Oh, damn you.
I feel a little bit better. Like, I actually showed restraint because I didn't take that one. Yeah. But I wanted to say that, in the case of, I actually had on this podcast, one of the nice parts of doing it, like meeting with filmmakers like Ben Wheatley, whose new film, Free Fire, it's in theaters.
Yeah.
It's in theaters as we speak. I'm going to say it again. Free Fire is in theaters right now.
Yeah,
Ben Wheatley's here in theaters all over this great nation of ours. But anyway, so do you know the name Volker Schlondorf?
Yes. Of course I do.
Okay. Not everybody does.
Syndrome.
Exactly. Yeah. So he that was a movie that really had impact when I was, you know, coming up. And anyway, so I had a copy, and I went to he was already on Criterion, but I didn't have that one. I had an earlier one, but he signed mine. And then when I was in the closet, I grabbed that one. So to counter your story, I was familiar with
that.
I have two. So, but I can't. Well, I have to keep both because I have vocals.
Well, that one signed it. Yeah, it's great.
So in my introduction to you, to kind of finally get to talk about your films, because I'm trying to also get to know you a little bit, so pardon that. But Down Terrace. I just read a lot about it. When did it come out? Like 7, 8 years ago? Maybe a little bit more?
Yeah, 2009 it was made, so it might have hit here.
Oh, 8 years ago. 10, yeah. Right. This was your first feature?
Yeah.
All you read about was this filmmaker's first feature and how incredible it was, you know, like that this was...
Oh, that's nice.
It got really amazing reviews, I remember. Yeah. It was around the time of Sexy Beast and of a few other films that were coming out of England. And so I just remember going to see it and just being completely, really, like, blown away. And since then, been following your films right up through, I think, last year at Tribeca, actually, where I saw
High Rise
was playing there. Mm. So this film, Free Fire, takes place in, we were talking about London and New York back in our childhood days. This takes place in Boston.
Kinda. It's never mentioned in the film.
Oh, it isn't?
No.
Oh, I do. Well, that
but
part...
But it is in all the press. That's the thing. But Amy and I are really conscious of that. Of not.
So maybe I shouldn't even mention that.
Well, you can do. It's fine. Okay. So it's out there now. I mean, I've just done all the Q&A's in Boston, so I've broached it.
Well, there it makes sense to kiss up, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. I was, you know, that was the whole thing of, like, I knew eventually I'd have to do a Q&A in Boston, and I didn't want to... You know, I wanted to head that one off of the path because I knew that they've made films in Boston with Boston actors and they still would cross about the accent. So I knew we had no chance. You know? Mm-hmm. But, and I think Amy and I have always been quite vague about dates and locations and all the films. You know, there's no...
She's your wife and
co-writer or sole writer.
You come up with a lot of the sort of the broad swaths or the broad...
Well, on Kill List I did and on Free Fire I did, but I didn't write... Okay. I didn't have anything to do with the writing of Field in England or High Rise, so that's all her.
Field of England was a novel? Is that what it was?
No. High Rise was.
Okay.
It was a J.G. Ballard novel, but Field in England was an original piece.
Okay. So you were sort of a director hire on that? Was that what...
Not on High Rise.
No, I'm sorry, on Field of England.
No, that was something that we, you know, Amy came up with, and we, Rook Films is...
And then you brought on somebody to pen it?
Amy wrote it.
We'll start over, because I apologize, Ben.
That's
this is not swift enough for this. I'm clearly in over my head, I promise you.
I've been cheating by caffeinating myself.
You are, okay. But, I'm drinking tepid water here.
Fiji water.
Yeah, but I promise you... I've seen all the films. All right, so wait, which one, though, was there a separate... Did Amy not... You guys not write? You mentioned one film, I thought.
No, well, so Down Terrace, I wrote with Rob Hill. Kill List, I wrote with Amy.
Mm-hmm.
Sightseers was written by Alice Lowe and Steve Oram, and then Amy rewrote it.
Okay.
Field in England, Amy wrote.
Mm-hmm.
High-Rise Amy wrote, and then this one.
She really does write.
Yeah, yeah, she writes all of it. And but as the director, mm-hmm. everyone assumes I write it in the same way that that most people assume that the actors mm-hmm. write it.
No, know. As they're saying it, they're just kind of winging it. It
comes up into their minds. So, sure. yeah, which is a a point of contention. You know, so everyone just assumes that the director writes stuff or has rewritten it. Mm-hmm. You know, rewritten the script, but it's not always the case.
Right. Yeah, sure, sure. Well, some films, of course, go through quite a bit of as you adapt to some degrees the material to the voice of the actors or what have you, or they'll come up with suggestions and that kind of thing, and you probably take them, I'm sure, to consideration.
Yeah, all our films have got, except, well, High Rise and Field in England, there's no improvisation in at all, but pretty much not verbal improvisation anyway, mm-hmm. and the other films are more or less bits of improvisation, from full improvisation to kind of paraphrasing.
Mm-hmm. Were you always interested in satire when you were coming up? And was that something that just...
I'm just generally sarcastic, so it's mm-hmm. kind of... there's no other position. It's kind of hard to... I think I would find like a straight drama hard to do. Mm-hmm. I'd probably try and make them, but then it would become sarcastic, you know?
Yeah, and the watching Free Fire, it's one of the bloodiest of your films for sure. I mean, in terms of the pure amount of maybe the final chapter.
Yeah, it's kind of
because everything lets loose.
Yeah, it's kind of probably the most frantic. I don't know if it's the most violent. I think Kill List is the most violent because the violence in it is so affecting in a way that the Free Fire violence is less affecting, I think.
True, and probably there's a higher body count in Sightseers now that I think about it. Very possible. We're going to have to do some.
I think it's Field in England because you've got to take into account the whole of the English Civil War.
So were there films that you took into consideration when you were making this one at all? Or
I mean, lots of stuff goes in. Everything is is the result of seeing lots of films. So, and I did a kind of a statement thing when I made the movie, when we first made the film, and I said it was like basically from Asphalt Jungle through all the 40s stuff and 50s mm-hmm. stuff, through Scorsese stuff, through The Outfit and Point Blank and da da da, and then into the 90s cycle of kind of Heat and Reservoir Dogs. So those were That was kind of where I was sitting within it, and also Carpenter's movies and all that. So, where the 90s feed back into the 70s and 80s movies as well. Mm-hmm. But when I made it, I felt probably it was closer to like Evil Dead 2 or to Raising Arizona or After Hours. It was more that kind of the kind of kinetic camera work and the comedy of nerves rather than the kind of the straight up crime stuff.
A comedy of nerves. So in other words, where main characters are not really in their comfort zone.
Yeah, things become more and more difficult.
Yeah, the things start to pile up and they're out of their element to a great degree, right? These aren't
Which is more After Hours and
right, for sure.
Yeah, but I think Evil Dead 2 is certainly that the slapstick stuff in that going back, but the tonal thing of shifting from horror to comedy to horror backwards and forwards really quickly, I think, is something I've always done in the movies I've made as well.
Right. Yeah, and that's a tension release, obviously.
Yeah, it's management of audience to a degree of not really horrifying them to turn them off, but then reward, you know, it's like what's funny, what's not funny, where, you know, and that helps you put them on the back foot so that they're not reading too far ahead of the film.
This one, because it takes place in the 70s, were you and Amy, I guess, because she was writing the screenplay, I mean, obviously there's the typical hair and leather jackets and costume, but I mean, what about the other more subtle aspects of trying to write something that's takes place in America in the 70s, in terms of just the way people interacted, engaged, spoke with each other?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, I think always looking to the past is a tricky one, because really, if you made a film that was really like how they spoke in the past, it would probably be impossible to watch for a modern audience. in terms of the kind of level of sexism and level of racism, you'd be going, oh God, this is fucking too harsh to watch. So there's a degree of meeting that halfway.
Really?
I think, you know, I think you see in everything, you know, that there's a subtle kind of, well, you know, we don't want to go back there too much.
What do you make of that? Do you feel like that's a compromise on your end, or do you understand it?
I understand it because it's meant to, there's certain things you don't, you want to address in a film that you don't need to go into other areas because that's a whole other film, you know, and it's a whole other load of stuff. And maybe in entertainment, that's not somewhere where you want to be in those moments, you know. And we certainly felt it in High Rise as well, you know, that the actual attitudes of people were kind of alien to now. You see it in, I think you see it also in costume drama, like people's real attitudes would have been so much harsher usually in stuff that's Victorian age stuff that the modern audience would look at and go, fuck that, yeah, these people are horrible, I can't
and you may not be able to get past that.
Yeah.
In other words,
and also the other thing is accents is like, certainly again in High Rise, if we'd have done it as proper British accents of the 70s, everyone would be going, well, why are they talking in such a stupid way, you know, when you actually listen to how people talk, that it was very extreme. And we did a thing with Liz Moss was doing an English accent, and I gave her Helen Mirren as an example, but Helen Mirren in an interview in like 72 or something, and we listened to this thing, and it's a famous interview with Parkinson where he's a bit, something happens and she's like offended by some kind of, he's been a bit sexist and awful, and she puts him in his place. But her accent is completely different from modern Helen Mirren. And we're listening to you going, wow, this is really weird, this voice. And then you start to listen to all the other people around it on news reports going, fuck, everyone speaks really weirdly. Yeah. So if you're going to go for that kind of realism, then all of a sudden it becomes like a sci-fi thing, you know. Mm-hmm. It would be, and I think the modern audience would find it impossible to get over the accents before they could even get to what they were saying, you know. Yeah. So there's levels of that you have to deal within it. But in terms of like, I kind of think of it in terms of this film is my, because it's my first American film, but it's also about people coming to America in a way. So it's like you've got the Irish coming to America in it, and the African characters coming to America, and they're all a bit out of their own comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And in a way, in the same way, on a filmmaking metaphor level, it's like this film is me coming to America after making genre films which are inflected from American filmmaking. Finally coming and trying to do the, you know, genre with a big G type kind of movie, and that's still having my hands held by Europeans as we do it.
Mm-hmm. You could have been wedged into the genre filmmaker role early on and kept there, but for some reason you've entered more of the mainstream of filmmaking.
Could hardly say that what I'm doing is mainstream. Yeah, I mean, it's like the audiences aren't there yet, I don't think.
It's possibly so, but in the film festivals, are they still, for instance, as one example, are they still putting you in the midnight movie category?
Well, Free Fire was at Toronto, yeah, and it won the audience award, so I was like really happy about that. But we'd moved through all the different. I think we'd done, you know, had the. I can't remember what the categories are called now, but they, you know, the High Rise was one of the, you know, 7 o'clock showings, one of the big strands, and then Field in England was a Discovery kind of strand as well. Yeah,
so it doesn't make it into.
So I bounced around basically in all different types of thing. Yeah, but being big in having your film shown at prominent festivals is not mainstream, I don't think. It might feel like mainstream to us because that's all we're in the bubble of reading about stuff about film, but it certainly isn't to the proper audience. The proper audiences are the largest, you know, cinema audiences knows nothing of Toronto or Cannes or any of these things.
I just look at it as one way to kind of gauge how.
Yeah, within that ecosystem, then the films have become bigger. But there's another world where films don't even go to festivals and they just get released.
Sure,
and that's like that's where it is. Yeah.
You just bypass the festival.
Well, I mean, I love festivals, obviously, and they're great. But I think that to make a film that
doesn't need the press and the mechanisms that the film festival gives so many films.
Yeah.
Right? They may premiere as a kind of more of a just a, you know, a more of a prestige.
Yeah.
You know, like a lot of big films might. More
oh, yeah, they lend the films off
they'll,
to the show. Yeah,
they'll
yeah,
put the premiere in the festival.
Yeah,
it would have
been the day before it's released.
Precisely, exactly. It's going to be right. Well, Ben Wheatley is the director of Free Fire, among other films, and it is currently in theaters. Go see Free Fire with, let's see, who's in the cast? Brie Larson, of course. From
Shelter America Copley, Army Shelter. Hammer.
It's got the greatest cast of names. Killian yeah. Murphy.
Yeah, Sam Riley.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Smiley. And Noah Taylor. I could go on.
That's
Babu Cisse of Gorillaz, which has just come out.
Okay, yeah. Okay. I haven't seen that one yet. But it was a lot of fun to see. The whole thing does take place in pretty much in one setting.
In real time. Yeah.
So that's a whole other...
It's 90 minutes, so it's mercifully short. Yeah. So there's time to get to the bar, dinner, all that kind of thing.
You can fit it all in one night.
You have a drink beforehand, not worrying about needing to have a pee halfway through the film. These things have all been thought about.
It's all appreciated, Ben. Thank you very much. Thank you for putting up with my shenanigans too. And
fine. I'm hoping that the sound of whoever the waiter is being having his head banged against the wall out there is going to can be recorded on these mics because it's quite good.
It's fine. He's actually banging his own head against the wall. So in this case, it's okay. As I'm going to in a few minutes myself. Thanks again. I appreciate it.
Cheers, man.
And I get embarrassed every time that I passes you. I don't care if it's only hard to eat. You clearly have a life that's forgotten me. And I got to learn to get out of my knees. And she tells me, baby, darling, gonna rescue you. And she tells me, sweetheart, I've been there myself. It's true. I spent way too long.
Music on this episode of the podcast is brought to you by Gabrielle Marlena from her album Second Guess. For you New Yorkers, Gabrielle will be playing this coming Sunday. Actually, she's got a residency at Pianos, which is a club in the Lower East Side. And she'll be there at 9 o'clock this Sunday, April 30th. And I will be trying to get there myself. I have plans to be at the Montclair Film Festival, as I already mentioned. But then my plan is to go see Gabrielle perform her songs at Pianos. These you heard a little bit of Rescue You, and now I'm going to be playing a little bit of another song called Second Guess, going into my conversation with, appropriately enough, Brett Burns, son of Burt Burns, who is the subject of the film, and Brett's co-director, Bob Sarles, and their film is, again, called Bang, the Burt Burns Story, which is currently... which will be in theaters again on April the 28th, just coming right up later this week.
Missing you is physically exhausting for me. And the truth is, I think you deserve this music. And it's always a question of whether it's about who you are. Who are you representing to me? And were you the one who I wanted to lie and support through?
the White Soul Brother, they called it. He put the soul in the music.
One of the greatest songwriters of all bloody time. I mean, he's as simple as that.
Boy Bunch was a genius in his business.
I love this guy. This is my kind of guy.
When you saw him, you said, that go Burt Bryan.
He was just writing them songs.
He was on fire.
And he met a man, same as Tommy Ryan, Tom Vietboy. He didn't know he was the head of the mob.
What the hell are you doing with these people?
Burt Bryan scared important people in the record business, and they're still scared.
You have got yourself into shit you have no idea.
I did it when I had a dope.
The miracle of Skyping and iPhones, we managed to pull this off. So thanks, guys. I'll just jump in because I want to, you know, respect your time. I know you have another call in a little while. So the name of your documentary is called Bang, the Burt Burns Story. And it's opening at least in select theaters, I assume. That's a question. Sorry.
Yeah, we're opening in New York next week, Thursday at the IFC Center, and then Los Angeles the following week, the Lindley Melo, and a couple of dozen other cities around the country.
Oh, beautiful. So that's all on the 25th of April?
On the 25th of April at the IFC, we begin in New York, yeah.
Oh, very good. Okay. That is also, by the way, that's the 25th, right? That also happens to coincide with my mother's 80th birthday, so I don't know if that was intentional or not. I just want to say one other thing that's about me, and then I promise the rest of the call will be about your film, and that is that I spent 10 years working at Sony Music. It wasn't necessarily that creative of a position, but for a musician of sorts, it was a great experience to work in the music industry. But I've always had a lot of just interest and enthusiasm around the history of music, American music especially. And so I really, you know, I was, I really found it to be an enjoyable documentary.
Thank you. Yeah, we love Sony Music. They're releasing the soundtrack, the companion CD soundtrack to the film as well. And it's all the Bang Records and Shout Records Masters with Sony. So we're really grateful to that.
Oh, terrific. Nice kind of confluence then. Is it the Legacy guys? John Jackson.
Yeah,
John is an old friend, so that's nice. So I'll make sure that he gets wind of this conversation. So now I can't imagine, Brett, Brett Burns, what is your connection to this story? How did this ever fall into your lap?
Well, my father died when I was 2.5 years old, so I never knew him. He knew he was going to die young, and he would tell my mother, my children will know me through my music, because he just knew that that rheumatic heart was going to give way, and it did. And in 1967, he just disappeared, and he was written out of the history books. He was never recognized by any of the halls of fame. So my sister and I set out to tell his really dramatic life story in order that he would get recognized for his body of work. And so that was the sort of genesis of the film. Out a couple years ago by Joel Selman, Here Comes the Night, also a musical that's heading to Broadway next season called Peace of My Heart. So my sister and I really set out to just tell this story in order that he would get recognized for his music.
Oh, so, right, to set the record straight, no pun intended. Pun intended. You said he had a rheumatic heart, so he wasn't even expected to last those 30s, what, did you say 37? 37 years?
Yeah, 38 years.
38 years. He wasn't even expected to live that long, but he lived a lot, right? He lived outlived his own life expectancy, even though obviously he tragically died very young.
Yeah, he was told he was going to, he wasn't going to make it past his early 20s. Rheumatic heart patients generally didn't live long. And he just lived life like there was no tomorrow. And I think that you can really see that in not just in the songs that he wrote, but he lived his life.
Right. And you then, because you're not a filmmaker, correct, you contacted or connected ultimately with Bob, right? Is that how you two came together?
I was introduced to Bob by Joel Selman, the author of the book, who just kept saying to me, you've got to meet Bob Sorrells. And Bob and his wife, Christina,
By the way, yeah, the play, now that has been like kind of going through, what was it, was going through like a trial run at a off-Broadway or at a some sort of regional theater first?
Well, we developed the musical in New York City for the last decade, and we started the New York Theater Workshop in East Village where Rents was born, and then we went to New York Stage and found the Ambassador where Hamilton did its pre-off-Broadway work, and we were off-Broadway in 2014 at the Signature Theater, and it was really like an out-of-town tryout in town. We decided to put the show up on the boards in New York in front of the New York critics, and we had a great expected run, and the New York Times gave us a positive review and called the show gorgeously tuneful. So, yeah, it has been an extraordinary labor of love. We've been working on the show for close to a decade now, and we're so excited to get to Broadway and get it back on the board.
Well, it's got to feel great to have all these projects, and maybe the most, I guess, one that'll be the most broadest in reaching out to people is the documentary. Again, it's called Bang, the Burt Burns story. It's got to feel great, and you know that all this stuff is coming together. And I'm wondering if you feel, and I don't mean this to be a tacky question, so I apologize ahead of time. But I wonder if you feel either closer to your father. I know you don't have memories of him, but how does that feel on a psychological level, if I can ask such a personal question?
Yeah, it's a great question. My sister says in the film that all our memories of our father are someone else's, and that really is true. Mm. We didn't know him, so it was knowing him through his music and knowing him through the people that he made the music with. And so the journey of making especially the documentary and meeting all of his colleagues, it's been extraordinarily rewarding, and it did bring us closer to him. And to get to know him through his music, through the making of the film, and through the musical, we were able to bring that to life on the living stage. And so that actor playing Bert every night really did feel, somehow, some small way, like we had brought my dad back to life. And so that's just been incredible.
Who is the actor, by the way?
Well, we've had different actors in the lead part over time. When we go to Broadway, we'll be looking at the part again.
I see. Very good. I just wanted you to know that I have a very good voice. Not that he's a singer, but I wanted to talk about. I feel bad. I want to actually bring Bob in before I get into, because I do want to discuss some of your dad's legacy. In terms of what he brought to the music industry, as well as just to the pop culture. Because I want to talk about the Latin music revival that he was really largely responsible for making popular and to bring it into the popular mainstream, I mean, it never went away, of course, in Harlem and in other places in the country, but he really made it this popular genre for, I guess, in the 60s, right? Or is it even earlier? I guess. Yeah, he worked with John Jackson, by the way, just for forever. I haven't seen him in a while, but, I used to see him on a daily basis up at Sony when I was there.
Yeah, he's one of the coolest guys in the record business. He's constantly gigging with the Jayhawks, and
Oh, I know. I think I used to. I may have even gone to a Jayhawk show with him before he was doing that. That's how far back I go with him. Yeah, I met him in the 1996 or something.
He's really different, right, than a lot of people that you find in record labels.
Well, he's old. He was very young when I met him, and I don't know how old he is now, but he was this kid, but he was so loyal to old world music industry, and he loved Americana so much. So it makes complete sense that he would have been in on this project.
Yeah, he's been an incredible ally for us for some time now. They're putting out that soundtrack CD, and of course, Sony was just the natural place for this to be. My dad's masters are sprinkled around pretty evenly between Sony and Warner and Universal, but
Yeah, they picked up the Bang catalog, right, at some point?
Right. My mom sold Bang in 1979 to Walter Yednikoff at Columbia Records, and so it's been there ever since.
Yeah, I remember. Hey, Bob.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for being tenacious, man. I was just talking a little bit to Brett about just about his dad and his relationship, feeling like how it felt to went with these various projects, and if it brought, it made him feel like he knew his dad more, and kind of talking about that. But then I wanted to talk about the specific music legacy that Brett was really responsible for, as that Bert was responsible for. As Brett mentioned before, for some reason, more or less erased Burns from the
its history books for some. I mean, maybe that's a little exaggeration, but
I don't think so at all. I don't think it was accidental. I think it was intentional.
Talk about that then first, because we can talk about the specific music.
I think that Bert pissed a lot of people off, and Bert hung with some scary guys.
Right.
And as it turned out, two of the major keepers of the flame. In terms of telling rock history, go-to people that journalists and musicologists went to were Ahmet Ertegun, who's the founder of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and Jerry Wexler, who kind of held core Florida for many years, and music journalists would come and visit him. And these guys, things didn't end well with Bert. And they were, I think, pretty much committed to not acknowledging the legacy of Bert Burns. And I think that has a lot to do with why. And then there's the other thing, which is that, you know, how many songwriters and producers do people really know? I mean, they know Phil Spector, they know Carole King, they know, you know. But beyond that, once you scratch the surface, there aren't a whole lot of names that are easily recognizable by the general public. Maybe for us record nerds, there are, but not for the general public.
Sure, right. Yeah, a lot of record nerds that read all the liner notes and who take pride in having all the B-sides and all that kind of thing. Yeah, for sure. One thing that I enjoyed just from a musical dimension of the film was that, as I said, you know, Latin music, of course, was always a huge thing in New York City, especially uptown, where primarily the clubs were and musicians lived. But Bert was really responsible, almost single-handedly, unless I'm mistaken, for bringing it into the mainstream. It was like this huge pop trend from the late 50s into the 60s. I don't know how long it lasted exactly, but, you know, and then there were all these mainstream pop singers did their Latin-tinged hits and all that, but he was primarily responsible for that.
Well, certainly, I would say that's true, and, you know, the biggest example of that is Twist and Shout, which is all, you know, Cuban and Latin rhythms and time signatures.
Well, it was like a variation of La Bamba, too.
Sure, absolutely.
Mm. And you have in, we should mention, since you brought up Twist and Shout, one of those guys from that Liverpool band, that obscure Liverpool band,
right,
is in the film, is he not?
That's correct. Paul McCartney makes a significant appearance in the film.
Oh, that's right. That's what his name is. Thank you for reminding me. And then also, I don't, you know, this guy, I mean, he had such an ear for hits. One of my favorite songs ever is Here Comes the Night, and it was Van Morrison made a hit on Bang Records.
Right, you want to hear this?
Van Morrison's first band then on Decca Records, yes. My dad was one of the first Americans to go and work in the UK during the British invasion, and he had, you know, he could just pick anybody he wanted to work with at Decca, and he decided to work with Van Morrison's them, and with Lulu, and a couple other bands he'd never heard of before, but yeah, that was the big moment there where Burns and Van Morrison connected.
So he co-penned that song?
He wrote Here Comes Night alone. Yeah.
He wrote it alone?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, I'm going to definitely play a clip of that song just to remind those who don't know that song, because it's really one of the great songs.
And most people know the will recognize the version by them, but if you the version by Lulu, which was also produced by Bert, is a completely different take on the same song, and it's absolutely wonderful.
The light, the long, the long and lonely night. I can see right out my window, walking down the street, a girl, but she's with my guy.
I think as Brett, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the Lulu version was released first, and then the Them version knocked it off the charts. Is that correct?
I think you're right, and the other remarkable thing about that song and those two recordings is that Jimmy Page is playing guitar on both of those sessions.
Come on.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Jimmy Page was one of my dad's discoveries. You know, he used him on those Decca sessions and brought him to New York to work with all of the Atlantic artists that my dad was working with at the time. But Mom and Jerry wouldn't give him a visa, so my dad had to send him back to England, where he ended up performing Led Zeppelin and recording a song called Tribute to Burt Burns on Led Zeppelin 1, which didn't make the cut.
Oh, my God.
Released.
Another... Was that also part of what Bob referred to before, part of this agenda that they had?
We don't know, but my guess is that after everything that went down there with Burt and Jerry Wexler and Atlantic, that you know, the last thing that those guys wanted to see on their big new signing was on called Tribute to Burt Burns. So one day I hope to find out from Jimmy Page himself what happened there.
Brett, is your mom around? Is she still around?
No, she passed away just at the end of February. It was really shocking. She joined me and Bob in Miami for a festival screening and got a standing ovation from a sold-out audience and joined us for the Q&A after. And, I think she was really looking forward to being part of this celebration. And just, 73 years old.
Oh, no. I'm sorry to hear that. But I'm glad she got to see the film in its final form and experience, you know, Burt's name being his legacy being rectified to some degree with, again, not only your film, which I'm going to remind people is called Bang, the Burt Burns story, which premieres theatrically on April 25th, but also the play and there was the book, you said, or?
Yes, the book Led the Way. The great Joel Selvin, who's written just a bunch of, fantastic books and was legendary columnist at the San Francisco Club. He was really the world's leading authority, still is, on Burt Burns, and he wrote a 430-page book that really tells the story in great detail, and was an enormous success back in 2014.
I know you guys have to wind down. You have another thing shortly, but I just wanted to ask one more question, which is pretty important, which is how you got Steve Van Sant, little Stevie Van Sant, to provide the voiceover for the film. How did that relationship come about, Bob?
Well, we'd actually used the book as the basis. Joel Selvin's book is the basis for the narration. I extracted about 20 pages of copy out of the 420-page book to be the glue, the connective tissue, to help tell our narrative. And what we had originally done was hack the audiobook version, and I extracted the narration that I needed for scratch purposes. And then when Brett and I were sitting around talking about who should narrate this, we thought that a celebrity narrator would help market the film. And we knocked around a few ideas, and I mentioned Michael Imperioli, the actor from The Sopranos, whose voice I've been hearing on commercials. And I said, I kind of like the Sopranos connection. And he says, oh, well, what about Stevie Van Zandt? And I said, well, yeah, of course. But who knows Stevie Van Zandt? He said, well, I do, because he's coming in as a producer on our Broadway play. And I said, you're talking to Stevie? And he said, sure, a couple times a week. And I said, well, my God, ask him if he'll... if he'll narrate our film, and he did, and he did.
It's terrific. By the way, Michael Imperioli did this podcast.
Yeah.
He was terrific.
Great actor.
Yeah, he's a great actor, and he's a really nice man. So I guess this is a good place to leave it, as any. Thank you both, and especially because of all those glitches. I really apologize about that. Sorry. Let's just remind people that Bang is coming out in select theaters. There will be a soundtrack. I hope to get a copy myself. I'll have to look up John Jackson. But it will be on the Legacy reissue label, Sony's reissue label, and lots of Burt Burns out there in the universe, fortunately, thanks to his son, Brett, and his co-director, Bob Sarles. Thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Adam.
I enjoy the opening, and I'll talk again hopefully soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Adam.
Okay. You're welcome.
Of the night.
right out my window, walking down the street, my girl with another guy. His arm around her like it used to be with me. Ooh, it makes me want to die.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to episode number 405 of Film Wax Radio. We have some great shows coming up. I always say that, but it happens to be true. Bob Hawke, who is a independent film industry legend, he's an icon. He'll be on the show. Another art house industry icon, Karen Cooper, who is the programmer at the other program, I should say, at Film Forum. We had on her colleague a few weeks ago, and Bruce Goldstein, and now we're having on Karen Cooper in just a couple of episodes. Also coming up is a conversation with Oren Moverman. I think I mentioned that already, as well as Josephine Decker and Zephyr Thrawell. I'm just making up. I got to talk to Zephyr, who I've been running into almost every day at the Tribeca Film Festival, where Flames has had its world premiere. And I've been running into him and talking to him a lot, so I should get his last name down before the show. Anyway, and as I mentioned, Joe Berlinger and so much more coming up on Film Wax Radio. Remember to subscribe on iTunes and leave us a nice rating and review, and it really makes a big difference. People have finally been doing it when the numbers are going up a little bit, and I'm actually finding the podcast on searches on iTunes, which was the goal, but we're not nearly there. We need to double the current number, which is just around 70, so I don't say that proudly. I love to get the numbers up there. So thank you for taking a moment of your time and just giving us a nice little review on iTunes. And then also, you know, the show is on Stitcher and on YouTube, and I've been trying to get it better about putting it on SoundCloud. I got to get an account. I guess I need to do that and get it on Spotify and all these other places, Google Play, blah, blah, blah. But they're not there. But they are on iTunes. And it's also on the Rooftop Film site. And, you know, it's not so hard to find my show. It's called Film Wax Radio, which is part of the Showbiz Studios podcast network. And also presented by Rooftop Films. So thank you for listening to this episode again. My name is Adam Shartoff, and I just ask you to please take care of yourself and the ones you love. Until next time. Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs.